Display a granite marker in a park that has a display already of the Ten Commandments. In a unanimous decision, the court said local governments have the right to display what they want in a public park and not worry about violating the First Amendment. Justice Samuel Alito wrote for the court that displays in parks are not the same thing as speaking in public parks. Alito said the display of a permanent park marker requires a special dispensation. An official with Chrysler says top executives of the struggling automakers are meeting with members of the president's auto task force today. Chrysler chairman and CEO Bob Nardelli and other Chrysler executives are meeting privately with the administration panel. Chrysler and General Motors have received $17.4 billion in federal loans, and they want an extra $21.6 billion to stay in business. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
10,000 Villages supports programs on WILL. 10,000 Villages' 17th annual showcase of fair trade Oriental rugs is March 11th through the 14th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. There will be an informational seminar about Oriental rugs on Thursday, March 12th at 7 p.m. Support for today's broadcast comes from RGP Productions, presenting Music with Sunday Brunch from 12:30 to 2 at Luna, a gourmet tapas restaurant in the old train station due north of the MTD terminal off University Avenue. This Sunday, March 1st, featuring Maria and Company with Dorothy Martirano on the violin and Josh Houchins on bass.
Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. There is a field of study that is known as human factors in survival. And in plain English, this field aims at answering this question. Why is it that some people make it through the most difficult trials while others don't? That is the question that our guest for this hour of Focus 580, journalist Ben Sherwood, sets out to answer in his book, The Survivors Club. The subtitle is The Secrets and Science That Could Save Your Life. The book is out now, published by Grand Central Publishing, and I think you might find it interesting. There is also a website for the book that you can take a look at. That's thesurvivorsclub.org. And in this book, he takes a look at questions like, well, are survivors different? What is it about them that's different, the way that they think, the way that they live? And indeed, the book does offer some advice on ways that all of us can improve our chances in virtually any crisis. The book is out now. It's in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. And of course, questions and comments are welcome here on the program. The only thing we ask of callers is that people keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving along. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call in 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Sherwood, hello.
Hi there. How are you, David?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Great. Thanks.
Thanks very much for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. Was there, in fact, some particular thing, some event, some experience that got you thinking about this and wanting to get into, delve into this subject as deeply as you have?
I think like most people, I needed something like this in my own life. That is, I've got family and friends who are dealing with some pretty tough stuff. A family member with a serious medical diagnosis, other pals with serious financial challenges. And I wondered, what are the secrets of the world's most effective survivors and thrivers? What do they know that the rest of us don't? And how can we get some of what they've gotten? So I went out and interviewed people who have beaten the odds in all kinds of situations, from plane crashes to cancer to car wrecks to violent crime, natural disasters, foreclosure, bankruptcy. And I began to discover that these folks aren't that different from us. In fact, we're all kind of made the same way. We all have an inner survivor personality, if you will. And that's what I laid out and explored. And so turns out that it was actually quite useful because I've been able to apply a lot of these lessons in my own life and my friends and family too.
Yeah, and so as you say, maybe when people think of, hear that title, hear that subtitle, they're thinking of things like, and you do deal with in the book, you know, if, God forbid, you were in a plane crash. But you're dealing with, you have talked to people who have dealt with a wide range of things, huge challenges in their life, like, you know, people who unexpectedly lose their job, people who they go to the doctor and the doctor says to them, you have cancer, people who have been assaulted, a very wide range of stuff that might seem on the face of it to be really different kinds of situations and would require a different kind of response from the person.
Right. So I found that in all kinds of crises that there is a survivor personality, there's an outlook, sort of a lens that the most effective survivors share, whether it's a sudden trauma, a sudden shock, car crash, violent crime, or whether it's a chronic challenge, like a long-term illness, or whether it's sort of a middle challenge, something in between that lasts a sort of amount of time and then dissipates. But there is a certain awareness of a problem, a certain realism that takes over, a certain adaptability to the new facts, and a certain sort of action-oriented approach. And some people have got it naturally, and many people don't have it, but as I learned from experts around the United States and the world who study these things, these are learnable skills, these are learnable strengths, and I really wanted to learn them myself, and so I went through all kinds of survival training, the military, the Navy, the Air Force, and also the FAA and the plane crash school, in order to learn these secrets for myself and also to sort of share them with readers and family and friends.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that. But if, you know, for example, as you say, you did that and you took the course that's supposed to prepare you for the event of being in a plane and being in a plane crash and the cabin is full of smoke and you've got to get out. Or you go to this military training school where they train surface people to at least be prepared for the situation if they were in a helicopter. Helicopter crashes in the water. Helicopter starts to sink. What do you do so that you don't drown in the helicopter? So in both of these cases and some other things, that suggests that there are survival skills that can be taught and learned. How much really, though, how much of this really is something that you can teach someone, and how much has to do with aspects of an individual's personality that you would have to say that, well, probably they were born with that, or that aspect was set in their personality when they were pretty young, and that's kind of like not something that they've learned, but it's something that they are.
So that's a terrific question, very complicated, and lots of different dimensions. So I would try to break it apart into a couple of different pieces. The first piece is that experts look at the population in a crisis or an emergency, and they say that we basically fall into three groups. It's called the theory of 10-80-10. 10% of us are leaders, decisive, take action, clear-headed, and in a crisis, we are the ones who forge forward and solve the problem. 80% of us, the big middle group, are bewildered in a stupor. We experience something called perceptual narrowing. That's where everything sort of begins, it's sort of tunnel vision. And we wait for someone in a position of authority to tell us what to do. And then 10% of us do the wrong thing, counterproductive, negative, self-destructive behavior. And so my focus was, what makes the top 10% so effective? But I learned along the way that the experts are more interested in why the middle 80% are less effective, and how can we move those middle 80%, sort of the vast number of us, up into the top 10%. And some of it is genetic, and I'd love to discuss some of that with you. There's sort of a genetics of resilience and a genetics of being able to handle intense stress. And there's also a whole neurochemistry involved, sort of the brain chemicals that we pump determine significantly how we handle extreme pressure and stress. But there's also sort of some basic knowledge and basic sort of approach and attitude. Take this plane crash in Turkey, in Amsterdam, involving a Turkish airliner, or take U.S. Air 1549 on the Hudson. Those people were not trained to get off airplanes, and yet somehow in the U.S. Air case, 150 people managed to get off that airplane in a sort of case of organized chaos. There, those people understood that if they took quick action, and some of them may have been bewildered initially, but they must have snapped out of it and been able to get off the plane. There are definitely lessons that all of the security experts and safety experts I interviewed teach that say you can take action and you can make a difference in saving your life in all kinds of crises. If you are able to snap out of that initial bewilderment and stupor that affects so many of us and begin to make a plan and to act.
Mm-hmm. Well, that also, though, one wonders, say, take that case, for example, it seemed to come out well because people didn't panic. It seemed like they didn't panic and tried in a prompt but orderly way to, you know, to get out of the plane. But to what extent in a situation like that or other situations is the difference that there are a few people, like in that case, the cabin attendants, who are trained to deal with this kind of situation, and that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, other than the people are pretty much, you know, doing what those people are saying to do, so that it gets at this issue of maybe in some circumstances the thing to do is indeed to wait. Maybe you don't want to wait forever, but is indeed to wait for somebody to say, okay, here's the exit, do this, and rather than yourself and every individual saying, oh my God, I got to get out of here.
Right. So US Air 1549 is an excellent example, because the pilot did everything right, the flight attendants did everything right, and the passengers did everything right. A number of passengers were described as leaders who helped at the exits and helped women and children off first and the elderly. There was organized chaos, so there was a bunch of pushing and shoving, particularly in the back of the plane that was filling with water quickly. But what I take away from that case is that everybody, when they get on an airplane, needs to have a plan and needs to know that you said there wasn't any panic. Well, in fact, there's something that we call the myth of panic, which is that in these situations, and going back to disasters all the way back to World War II and earthquakes and all kinds of crises, sociologists who study panic say that, in fact, in disaster situations, panic of the kind that we typically think in the movies, that groundless fear in which people behave chaotically and sort of pure bedlam, that panic almost never happens. Hmm. And in fact, a sort of calm and quiet settles in over a situation, and there is what's called situational altruism, where people actually engage in altruistic behavior in which the common good overrides narrow self-interest. Now, there are always going to be people who are clamoring and clawing over the seats, and that's always described, people clawing and clamoring. But overall, you got 150 people who exit in a reasonably orderly manner. And to your point about whether or not it's better that people wait for instructions, here's a statistic that stunned me when I went to the crash evacuation course. 40% of the time, the flight attendants are incapacitated, and so you're on your own. That is, if you think that someone is going to lead you off the plane, you're wasting valuable time waiting for someone to tell you, go, go, go. You should be ready within the first 3 minutes and the last 8 minutes of a plane flight. That's when 80% of the accidents happen. In the first 3 minutes or last 8 minutes, plus three, minus eight, you should be ready to go and take action yourself. That doesn't mean that there are going to be 150 people at the exit pulling on the door. It means that you need to be ready if you're near an exit to do it, or you need to be ready to guide other people off quickly. So I think that panic rarely happens, if ever, and you have much more control of your destiny than you realize. And flight attendants, those folks, they're there as safety professionals on the planes. They're not just there to hand out pillows. They're really there as safety professionals, but sometimes you won't be able to count on them.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ben Sherwood. He worked as executive producer of ABC's Good Morning America and senior broadcast producer of NBC Nightly News. He's the author of two best-selling novels, The Man Who Ate the 747 and The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud. And he is the author of a recently published book. The title is The Survivors Club, The Secrets and Science That Could Save Your Life. You also can take a look at the Survivors Club website, and there's a quiz there that you can take if you're interested in finding out what kind of person you are, your survivor profile, and there are different aspects of people's personalities that put them into different groups depending upon how it is they respond to crisis. And if you're interested, you can do that. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One other, I've got a caller here I want to get to, but one other question, I think it's, you might think about two different kinds of situations. One where the crisis essentially just affected you. It was very much, now maybe there aren't that many pure cases, but I'm thinking of the difference between something like, oh, you're told that you have cancer and that you're in a plane full of people and there's a plane crash. And if you look at the different responses, the sort of the two extremes, the one that says, I'm in trouble here. I got to get out of here. To heck with everybody else, and the response that says we all need to get out of here. Is there some way, in fact, that you can make the argument that you can show that the person who actually thinks about the others around them and who says not just I have to get out, but we have to get out, actually ends up better in the long run than that person that is only thinking about himself?
Another very incisive question that gets at a lot of the studies that have been done on who survives in all kinds of situations. And one of the important survivor personality types is what I call the connector. A connector is a person who is attached to other people, whose social bonds with other people are very strong, and who typically takes care of other people before they take care of themselves. And I found a number of cases, famous disasters, famous survival situations, where connectors were actually the key to group survival. They are able to work with other people very well. Those social dynamics, those abilities, create sort of a greater survival response among the entire group of people who were affected. So in the case in the Andes, when the famous plane crashed in the 1970s, stranding a rugby team up on a glacier, in which a lot of people perished in the crash, there were a lot of survivors, and they were in the absolute worst place in the world, 12,000 feet on a glacier where no life is supportable. They had no winter clothes. They had no food. They had nothing. And a variety of survivor personality types emerged in that crash, and I studied that case very carefully and interviewed folks who were there. What you find is that there are some people who are believers. Those are people who pray to God for rescue, and they put their faith and they draw their strength from believing that a higher power has a plan and a reason for things happening. There are some people that I call realists, who have a brutally realistic assessment of the situation and deal accordingly with sort of the reality of the situation and make plans and adjust accordingly. And in fact, the guys who climbed out of that glacier climbed a 17,000-foot mountain and then proceeded to trek for 10 days to get help after 72 days stranded up there. Those guys were the ultimate realists. They saw that there was absolutely no help coming. They were all going to die of starvation eventually when they ran out of the nutrition that they had found, as you know, in the form of the other dead passengers on the plane. But there are other types, too. Connectors were the ones who actually made the group work well and function well in the dynamics of how they were going to solve their problems. They made sleeping bags using the ventilation from the air conditioning and heating system on the airplane. They made snow glasses to deal with snow blindness using the visors from the cockpit. They made snow sleds and snowshoes using seat cushions and Samsonite suitcases. So they work together as a group. So to your long answer to your short question, which is that there are different personality types that emerge. No one is better than another. And in fact, I think the reason why when you suggested that your listeners take the quiz, which I'm happy to make available to your radio station, not just our website, but also can live on your radio station website, that quiz can help people identify what their survivor personality type is and what they would deploy in a particular crisis. That's valuable information that actually we found can make a difference.
Yeah. So all of, you know, thinking that I was thinking about these different types and, you know, the different individuals and how that their response to the crisis fundamentally, you know, grows out of who they are, their personality, from the people who their first impulse is to pray, to those people who their first impulse is to be very analytical and look at the situation and say, okay, let's think about this and think about where we are and try to figure out what's the best response. And those people who just say, okay, look, this is where we are. This is it. And maybe we have some choices here and none of them are real good, but let's take the one that seems like the best and just go with it. And although those are all really different responses, so your feeling is that one is not necessarily better than another?
My feeling is that depending, so it's situation dependent. Mm-hmm. people get into the Survivors Club every second of the day across this country through many, many doors. Car crash survivors, heart attack survivors, cancer survivors, every second of the day it's happening. There are common personality types that help them get through the door. No one personality type is necessarily better than another because there are lots and lots of different ways to cope with a particular crisis. I have great awe and respect for people who are believers, people of deep faith, whose strength comes from their trust that God has a plan and will guide them on each step of the journey, whatever challenge they face. And in fact, I'd say that faith is the most universal survival tool. It's by far the most common survival tool among the people that I interviewed. And in fact, this was a big surprise, when I went to the Navy's Survival Training Institute in Pensacola, Florida, to interview one of the top experts on survival in the Navy, a guy who literally wrote the book for the Naval Institute Press on how to survive on land and sea. And I asked him, what is the most important survival tool in any situation? His answer, and I was expecting him to say a knife or some sort of piece of equipment, his answer was faith in God. He had interviewed prisoners of war. He had worked with prisoners of war. He had trained Marines and sailors for decades on how to survive in the most extreme situations. And his answer was, when it comes down to it, faith in God and faith in your family and friends will be what sustains you and gets you through. And all that other stuff, those are just tools and supplies.
Yeah. I talked earlier, it's sort of set up this dichotomy made as if to say that being in a plane crash with a bunch of other people and getting the diagnosis of cancer was different in the sense that one is just about you and one is about a whole bunch of people. But even assuming that you have family, that there are people who are important to you and close to you, that getting the diagnosis of cancer is not just about you. And having said all that, does being this personality type that's a connector, being the person that thinks about not just me but about us, does that in a situation like that where you're talking about ultimately the health consequences just affecting the one person, does being a connector actually help that person to survive more than if they were just saying, essentially this is just all about me?
This gets into the range of speculation for me. And as you know, I'm a journalist and interviewed a lot of experts and interviewed a lot of survivors. It's a very provocative question because the question really is, so what increases your survival chances? And if you're focused solely on yourself, do you have a better chance than if you're focused on yourself and the others around you? If I understand the question correctly.
Yeah.
I think that one of the ideas that comes through clearly in both the literature and in my interviews with survivors and experts is that having a purpose greater than yourself is a very important motivator and driver of survival. And so I would never judge someone who's solely focused on their own diagnosis. And in fact, I know lots of people personally, and also I know lots of people from my interviews who are very focused on their own diagnosis and not especially focused beyond themselves, and they have had very good results. So I don't know if that's – I don't believe that's determinative. But I do know that a purpose greater than yourself is one of the core ideas in developing a highly resilient personality. That is, people who can bounce back and recover from terrible challenges have purposes greater than themselves, and those are often family and friends. That is, your purpose for living is your daughter or your son or your wife or your family. And that purpose greater than oneself is a very, very big driver of resilience and survival.
Yeah. Well, certainly it seems to be very clear that there is a very, very clear relationship between the quality of people's lives, their health in a lot of dimensions, and their personal, having people that are close to you, important to you in your life, that no matter what happens to you, you're going to be better off than that person that is isolated and alone and doesn't have those connections.
Right. The statistics on this are stunning, just stunning. In fact, of all of the data that I looked at, I'd say there are two facts that just jumped out. One involves isolation, one involves faith. The isolation fact is that researchers analyzing isolated people after various health challenges conclude that isolation is as highly correlated with death as is smoking and death and cholesterol and death. That is the connection between social isolation and mortality is very, very powerful. And the greater connections you have, the greater social bonds you have, that significantly improves your chances of dealing with all kinds of life challenges. And that connection is as strong as what we all take for granted, which is the connection between smoking and health and cholesterol and health.
Going back to the idea that there are some survival skills that can be taught and learned, or that may be something as simple as where you sit in the airplane can enhance your chances of survival if there's a crash. Is this so situation specific, or is there something sort of overall that you could say? If you take one or two things away and carry them around in your pocket, metaphorically speaking, from this, you're going to be better off.
So I think the stool or the table or the three pillars of the survival equation are, first, the survivor personality or mindset. And what I mean by that is, and this is the part that you can carry around with you every day, that you can make a difference and that you are stronger than you know. And I'm not a self-help writer, and I'm not an evangelist or a proselytizer. I met person after person, regular people, slammed by life, and the experts who study them, who said that we don't even understand our strength and our ability to handle the situations that we're dealt. We are stronger than we know. If you have the lens that you can make a difference in whatever challenge you're facing, and you can improve your odds. And so survivors share a situational awareness and an action-oriented approach, and that's the first part. The second part is some basic knowledge and a basic sort of sensitivity to the fact that there are challenges around us or there are challenges around the corner, and we're all going to face them. And so some of that basic knowledge involves where to sit on an airplane. Some of that basic knowledge involves a curiosity about life and a search for some of the answers whenever you get into these situations. The burglar alarm in our house went off not long ago, and I had no idea what to do, and in fact I did everything wrong in the middle of the night. It was 2 a.m. and I embarrassed myself in front of my wife. I'm glad my son was sleeping, because I just had no idea how to respond or what to do. I took advantage of that opportunity to interview the cops who showed up an hour later and ask them what are the right things to do in one of these situations. And so the second leg of the survival equation and the increasing your chances of making it in different situations is a curiosity about, well, what should I have done in that situation that I got through? How can I handle that situation in the future? Turns out, by the way, that barricading yourself with the people you love is the correct response if your alarm goes off in the middle of the night or you hear a noise in your house, and don't go looking for trouble, the police said. That's just a recipe for disaster. And then, so those are the two. And then the third leg of it, I think, is this is the tool to carry along, which is that adaptability and resilience, those two qualities are qualities that are practicable, and those are twin pillar. Those are very, very important parts of being able to handle whatever you're going through, whether it's, for instance, an economic crisis or a health crisis. Adapting to the facts, changing your attitudes and behaviors to reflect what's really going on, and being able to keep going and pick yourself up and reconstitute and recover after the stresses and strains of that. Those two are muscles that you can build by working them out.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ben Sherwood. He worked as executive producer of ABC's Good Morning America and senior broadcast producer of NBC Nightly News. He's the author of two best-selling novels, The Man Who Ate the 747 and The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud. And he's also author of the book The Survivors Club, The Secrets and Science That Could Save Your Life. Grand Central is the publisher. The book is out now. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about it, there's a website for the book, survivorsclub.org, and you can look at that. And if you're interested, you can take this quiz that we mentioned. If you'd like to try to find out what your survivor personality is, there's a on the website, there's a quick version of that. It'll take a couple of minutes, and you can do that if you'd like. And questions are welcome here at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to resilience because I know that is the kind of thing that social scientists and researchers are interested in, and particularly have been doing work on this the last few decades, applied, for example, to families or to children, and asking this question. If you look at children who come out of just horrible circumstances, some are damaged forever, and some manage to come through it okay. And so the question is, why? Why do some do all right? And why not? And this gets back to this this question of, could it possibly be that it is so inborn that there might actually be gene or genes that code that, and that survivors in some degree, that survivors are born that way?
I absolutely believe that you just nailed it, which is that some survivors are born that way. And I did not begin this journey thinking that. I began thinking that we are the product of our parents and our homes and our schools and our churches and our synagogues and our life experience, and that we determine our resilience and ability to overcome whatever we face. I absolutely started there. I thought that it was a very, very simple answer, and I thought that the people that I would interview and meet left for dead on Mount Everest dealt with mountain lion attacks, that if I just dug deeply enough into their background, I could solve the mystery of how they've survived and perhaps share some insight. Quickly, I discovered this entire field that you mentioned of the genetics of resilience, and the scientists who are exploring what's called the 5-HTT serotonin transporter gene. So it's one complex of genes, the serotonin transporter genes. And among people who have the active version of these genes, the active protective version, they find that those people are much less likely to succumb to the stresses and strains of life and become depressed or anxious or dysfunctional, that they are protected, almost inoculated, like they'd had a shot and were immune to the stuff that makes other people, most of us, depressed, down, unable to function. And they've really done some serious and some fascinating science here. And I actually got myself genetically tested in England for this resilience gene as part of my research for the book. And when I got my results back, I was disappointed to learn that I was in this middle group of people who have one active and one inactive version of this gene. So I'm sort of in a group that I have some but not a lot of protection. And that resonates in my own life, which is that when I deal with tough stuff, I tend to get down for some period of time, and then I eventually pick myself up. I then decided that, so what if you get this bad deck of cards and you get dealt the hand that says that you don't have the active version, you have the middle range? What if you're not protected? Are you doomed? That is, are you not going to be a survivor? And I went to the dean of resilience studies in America, a man named Dr. Dennis Charney at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. He's the god of resilience studies in the United States. And he said that genes are just proteins. They're just the proteins in our bodies, and that the genes times environment, the G times E interaction, is what's important, and that you can't just sort of surrender to your genes, that you can control a great deal of your response in tough situations, and that, as I said earlier, you can practice resilience, you can practice optimism, you can practice purpose, you can practice social support networking, the things that make a person more resilient. So even if you do not have the genetic predisposition, even if you're not one of those lucky 33% who have the active serotonin transporter gene, you can still be a resilient person who can get knocked down and pick yourself back up.
It seems that if you were going to try to study how people reacted in an emergency, you could do this a couple of ways. You could find an actual emergency and do a look back and try to, as much as you can, reconstruct what happened and how people responded, which maybe could tell you something, although that's kind of problematic. You could set up an experiment. You could create an emergency kind of situation and put people into it and see how they would respond. But, of course, there are going to be limits there to what you can put people through, and the fact that they know it's going to You can't really take them by surprise. It seems like no matter what, how you look at this, it's almost impossible to actually see what real people would do in a real emergency when they really weren't expecting it. I mean, is it actually possible to do that?
David, this is the great sort of this is the great challenge of studying survival and surviving and thriving, which is that exactly as you described. Occasionally there's a surveillance camera monitoring a situation in a store where you can see what someone does in a violent crime situation and how they respond. Occasionally there's video of a fire as it engulfs a nightclub, and you can watch, in the case of the Rhode Island fire, how all those people responded and what they did and how long it took them to react to the flames on stage. So there is some ability to do it, but you nailed it. It's very hard in a really rigorous scientific way to study these people. So scientists are very clever, and I interviewed a number who went to the best laboratory they could find to study people under intense pressure. They went to the Special Forces Training Academy in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where they train Special Forces soldiers in dealing with survival and prisoner of war interrogation. And in this training, which is incredibly intense, it's just training, but they really, really simulate incredible pressure and stress and strain, and they deprive you, and they keep withhold food, and they put you through an incredible amount of pressure. And they can make your pulse go up to 170 beats a minute while you're just sitting in a chair during prisoner of war interrogation just through the techniques that they use. They then study those guys under intense pressure. They take their blood, they take their urine, they study their brain chemicals, and they've come up with some really interesting conclusions about the biology and the neurobiology of survival and resilience. And it turns out that those Special Forces guys under intense pressure pump a lot of brain chemicals that most of us don't pump as much of. And they have more chemicals that are the equivalent of fire extinguishers in their brain that put out that stress and fear and alarm response so that they can stay engaged and on task and focused in a crisis while most of us become bewildered and unable to take action. So it's incredibly hard to study, but they've come up with creative ways, and they're just beginning to peer into the science of why some people are much better in a crisis situation than others.
We have a caller to bring in then to the conversation, and this is someone listening in McLean County, and it's line number one. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Your conversation is fantastic. I'd like to see if you wouldn't mind talking about the crisis in our country, the economic crisis, and how would people work through that? Because that's become it is reality and obsession right at the moment. And I think people are just basically, like I said, kind of stumped, not knowing what to do next. What would you suggest people in general do? Retirees or people who have lost so much money where they may have to continue to work, or young people who think, you know, the elders have really ruined it for them?
Well, that's a good question. Can you apply this to the current economic situation that we're in?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the lessons of dealing with an economic crisis, I learned some things at the Air Force Survival Academy in Spokane, Washington, that I think are directly applicable to the crisis that the country faces, the economic crisis. The first is what we've discussed a little bit of before, which is called situational awareness, which is that I think many people, despite President Obama's speech to the nation and despite the obvious challenges, the collapse of banks, unemployment rate, the rest, I think there are a lot of people who still do not have a real situational awareness, that is a real understanding of the nature of the threat and the threat to themselves or their families, and are preparing plans to take action. And so that situational awareness is incredibly important, and I think it's beginning to sink in, but there are still some people who are in denial, which leads to the second point. The Air Force says, hug the monster. Hug the monster is a phrase they use that says, do not run from your fear. Embrace your fear and wrestle with it. So if you get a 401k mailing that you refuse to open up because you're afraid to see how much your retirement savings have fallen, that's the wrong response. The right response is to open it up and to wrestle with the fact that it is declining and then, as I said, to take some action. And I'm not an economic or financial expert, so I'm not in a position to offer financial advice, but the military experts and economic experts I've interviewed have all said that dealing directly with your fear, the more you deal with it, the more you try to make plans, the more expert opinion you reach out for, that thing that you're afraid of becomes more familiar and less scary. And that leads to the third point, which is another memorable Air Force phrase, eat an elephant one bite at a time. And by that they mean if you look at the entire economic challenge at once, your job loss, your foreclosure at once, it's so overwhelming that, again, many people resort to behavioral inaction. They do nothing. But if you take one bite at a time and accomplish one task at a time as you make your way toward recovery, you can get there little by little, and that's a much more effective way than trying to take on the whole challenge when people simply get overwhelmed and give up. So I would say those are three general ideas that apply from survival school and the survival literature to dealing with these specific economic challenges that everybody faces.
Now, as a whole group, that's an individual answer, which is actually terrific. But as a whole group, how do we get our country to get over the fear? Because I think people have just gotten so incredibly scared. And, I mean, rightly, some people have lost their jobs, don't have a way to go. But I think as a whole large group, and even globally, it's like all of us, I'm thinking there, all of us are looking at the doomsday scenario and the idea of hope and potential ability to come out. And one of the things, you know, I was born in another country. One of the things I totally admire Americans for is that we have the ability to create. We're fantastic inventors. And we have, it's almost like we've forgotten that we are. So how do we get people to go back and look at that?
I think that's the cover of Newsweek magazine is called Confidence Game, and my friends at Newsweek have written an entire cover story about whether Barack Obama can talk the United States out of a depression. They call him America's new shrink, and can the president, through his hopeful rhetoric and through his decisive actions, can he reverse that fear that you describe? And so this is beyond my area of expertise, but I think that fear is a fascinating subject in survival situations. And in fact, I wrote an entire chapter on the science of fear and how fear is both our greatest friend in a crisis situation. So fear is what will motivate you to stay up at night and work harder and deal with what you're dealing with if you know how to handle it. Fear can also become so overwhelming that you can't turn those alarm bells off in your head. And those alarm bells can become completely paralyzing and can lead to depression and anxiety and all kinds of self-destructive behavior. So this is a wild extrapolation, and forgive me, but I think that in the same way that individuals need to learn to flip the switch and turn that fear alarm in their heads off, which is what scientists told me they need to do, and they can do. It's a learnable thing. Same with the country that is somehow the country, and who knows how that's going to happen, but same with the country. The country needs somehow to be able to flip that switch from a place of fear and inaction and self-destructive behavior potentially to a place of action and getting things done.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, then I suppose that it raises in my mind, and perhaps we have touched on this, it raises in my mind the question of optimism and whether, in fact, you are an individual, if you're a half glass half full or a glass half empty person, and whether your general outlook, that is, whether you tend to be more optimistic or more pessimistic, is going to make a difference.
Optimism is one of those special sauces of survival. it's the magic elixir, and we all know optimists in our lives, and darn it, how can they be so optimistic in the face of tough stuff? And the science proves that people who have optimism, the people with optimism have better recovery rates in medical situations. There is absolute strong science to show that optimism is correlated with better results in medical crisis. Now, there's an important distinction here. And it's called the Stockdale Paradox, coined by Jim Collins, the great writer, in his book Good to Great, quoting Admiral James Stockdale, who was the highest-ranking American prisoner of war in Vietnam. Stockdale was asked who lived and who died in the prisoner of war camps in Vietnam. Stockdale replied, paradoxically, the optimists were the first to die. That didn't make any sense until Stockdale explained that optimists were the ones who kept on thinking they were going to be released by Christmas. And when they weren't released by Christmas, they were crushed and their spirits were dashed and they gave up. So realistic optimism is the special sauce or the elixir of survival and beating the odds. It's realistically facing the facts, as Jim Collins and Stockdale point out. Face the facts, but be hopeful that the results will turn in your favor eventually. So it's a complicated blend of realism and optimism that produces those best results.
Our guest is Ben Sherwood. His book is The Survivors Club, The Secrets and Science That Could Save Your Life. We have 5-6 minutes left, some other callers, so we'll keep on talking with folks. And next, the caller is in Champaign on line 2. Hello.
Hi. Mr. Sherwood, thanks for your program. It's very interesting. I had a question. I've always considered myself sort of a physical survivor and a bit of an adrenaline junkie, I guess I've discovered. So to explain that, in situations like, say, avoiding a car accident, I'm able to act on a dime and be really calm and then come through it, and it's like, wow, how did that happen? Or I'm a rock climber, and I feel very at ease and calm when I'm doing that, which would a lot of people would consider that a stressful situation. My question is, I don't deal very well with sort of economic stresses and things that deal with sort of like business or something like that. Is the part of my brain, is it something that, I mean, is it sort of, can it go across the physical into the more cerebral? And it's something I just have to learn to deal with those stresses that are not so physical. I hope that's somewhat clear.
It is clear, and I wish I could offer you an exact answer to it. I think that no one is arguing, and I certainly wouldn't argue that your physical response and your physical instincts in a survival situation, that those are automatically transferable to an economic analysis and dealing with economic stress. I certainly don't believe that, and I haven't encountered any evidence to suggest that. But I have encountered a lot of evidence that a lot of those skills are learnable, and I would say that it sounds to me like you've got the wiring, sort of the wiring, the neurochemical wiring and the genetic wiring to be a very responsive and quick-thinking and fast-acting person. And so I would have every confidence that those other skills for dealing with sort of other kinds of everyday stress, that those would be very easily learnable for you.
Okay. That's encouraging.
All right. Thanks. Well, thank you. Let's go next to someone in Bloomington, Indiana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I find that I'm not very resourceful, but I can be resourceful if I have prepared myself for an emergency. And when I was in the military, they used to try to prepare us. They would say, they would give us a bunch of what if situations, and they would say, what will be your actions and orders if such and such happens? And we had to answer those questions. I would find myself laying in bed at night thinking, okay, what would I do in this case? And what would I do in that case? And that's very helpful. I found that very helpful in appearing to be resourceful when the emergency struck.
And that's the military calls that 6 P's.
Okay.
Prior planning prevents blank poor performance.
Indeed. And this idea about eating an elephant one step at a time, one bite at a time, when I've been in emergencies, what often happens is there are many things that demand your attention right now, and you have to set up priorities. If you don't, you'll just be confused. You have to set up priorities, so you'll do one thing at a time and finish that job at least mostly before you go to the next one. And you also have to remember where your tools are, because in a confused situation like that, you have things that you're working with, and you have to remember where you left them, or you'll waste time, looking for things when there are urgent things to be done, and you can't find the tools to do them.
The amazing thing about search and rescue teams that I've interviewed and experts on lost person behavior, you describe it exactly right, which is that oftentimes when search and rescue teams find a person who has been lost in the woods or in another situation, they'll have a backpack full of gear and equipment, all of it unused. And that's because in the terror of being lost in the woods, so-called wood shock, people people actually behave in ways where they forget completely that they're carrying stuff in their pack that could be useful to the challenge that they face. So it's that literally what you describe, losing those tools,
yeah,
or not even being aware that you have those tools. And as you point out, the challenge is priorities, and to make your priorities have that lens, which is I can make a difference in the situation, but I have to wrestle first with the fear and get it under control, and then use that as motivation to make a plan, make a backup plan, and figure out what are the absolutely urgent priorities. And by the way, this isn't just about getting lost in the woods. This is when you get the terrible news from your doctor that you've got some sort of serious medical challenge.
Right.
It's the same exact set of response tools that we can use, which is, one, manage the fear, two, get as much information as possible, make a plan, make a backup plan, and begin to respond, because that can make a difference.
Good program. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're just about the point we have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute or so left. Earlier, you talked about the 10-80-10 theory, being that if you look at how people respond in a crisis, 10% are leaders. They're clear-headed. They seem to know what to do. The 80% are the people that are kind of bewildered and not sure, and they're, a lot of them are just kind of waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. And the other 10% immediately rush off and do the wrong thing. So given that sometimes in an emergency situation, you don't have a lot of time to think about what your response is going to be, and maybe you have not carefully in your mind rehearsed what you would do, so is it better to, you know, given the fact that maybe some people are going to do the wrong thing, is it better to take an action and maybe take the chance that it is the wrong thing? Is it better to do that than it is to wait for someone to tell you what to do?
Well, I think that that's very case-specific, and I certainly don't recognize it. Sort of what one expert once said to me was that's the ready, fire, aim approach to to survival.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly don't recommend firing before aiming, and I think that it's all very specific. There is a very interesting phenomenon in survival situations, all kinds, which is called passive inaction. Pardon me, active passiveness is the exact phrase. Active passiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And what active passiveness means is a person who sits back and waits to take action. That is, inaction, passivity, is a kind of action in a situation while they suss out the situation and figure out what they should do or get told what to do. So passive action is a good response, but it's also one in which you can't wait too long. So it's all very case specific, and there's no master recipe for surviving. You said earlier, what are the one or two things to take away? Because every situation is different. You know, what I take away at the end of the day, after spending a few years interviewing the most effective survivors in the world, is that we control more than we know. There's more that we can do to deal if we go into these situations knowing that we can make a difference. And so when I go to the movies at night, I notice there's a primary and a backup exit, even though I don't expect there's going to be any crisis or challenge in the movie theater. But I am aware now, I have more situational awareness, that things can go wrong, and I want to be ready for it.
A lot of interesting things in the book. If folks would like to read more, the title is The Survivor's Club: The Secrets and Science That Could Save Your Life. It's just out, published by Grand Central. Covers red, so you can locate it easily in the bookstore. Our guest is Ben Sherwood. He's worked as executive producer of ABC's Good Morning America, senior broadcast producer of NBC Nightly News, author of two best-selling novels, The Man Who Ate the 747 and The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud. And if people want to read more about the subject, also you can go to the website, which is thesurvivorsclub.org. And Mr. Sherwood, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. This program, Focus 580, supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. Well, that's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. Up more next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about the relationships between young and old social animals. Our guest will be animal behaviorist Ann Dagg, author most recently of The Social Behavior, of older animals. She'll join us at 106. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. The March wheat contract is trading at 559 and a half, up 6 1/4. May 566 and a half, up 4 3/4. Chicago March wheat 520 3/4, up 5 1/2. May 532, up 5 3/4. March corn 356, up 1 3/4. May 365, up 2. July 374 and a half, up 2. September 383 3/4, up 2 1/4. March beans 867, down 14. May 869 and a half, down 14. July 876, down 12 and a half. August 878, down 2 1/2. March meal 272.50, down 6.30. March oil 30.72, up 21. At the Merck in Chicago, February live cattle 81.45, down 75. April 84.77 and a half, down 57 and a half.